The lights are on red. We're away.
GPOD, the internet radio show about motorcycle road racing. Today is Friday, October 30th, 2009, and this is episode number 201. And as you might not have noticed, this is Bob Hayes. I am back. I'm hosting the show, and I've got Joel Cisek and Jim Race on the show. Hi, Jules. How you doing? Hi, Jim.
Hey.
Hey.
Okay, how was that intro? That was a little bit botched, but hey, let's let's talk about some racing, because it was last weekend not like it was in a lot of ways. It was like the pinnacle of racing. I think we had a couple of somewhat disappointing races, and we'll get to that later. But we also had some fantastic races,
and we and a lot of things got settled.
Yes, they did. What was it? Three championships settled in one weekend. That's
quite almost. Yeah. Almost. 2.7.
2.7.
Oh, sorry, 3.7. Sorry, 3.7. Right.
But I enjoyed it. I had a great Sunday. Just I watched it all on speed. It was like, four solid hours of motorcycle racing, because I watched the two World Supers, the 250s, and the MotoGP, and I enjoyed every one of them in different ways. I'll admit there was actually two little naps in that afternoon, but we'll get to that.
Jules and I were sort of laughing at each other, because we were like, instant messaging back and forth at like, what, 4, 5, and 6 in the morning while we're staying up trying. I'm like, oh, this is going to hurt later.
Well, especially with the World Superbikes being in Portugal and MotoGP and 250s and all that being in Sepang, time differential.
I think we started at 8 p.m. our time, and it finished at 8 a.m.
Yeah, no, it was totally insane. And I'm kind of pissed. So much wish that the Superbike folks would let us actually watch this stuff live. I'll pay for it.
I know. Exactly.
Oh, yeah. Does that not suck or what? That is so bad.
Yeah. Watching the final races of a championship that's come down to that through time and scoring is lame. It's fucking lame.
Yeah. Yeah. No, you have to have that's why I like to watch it on the TV. I mean, I've said that before. A big ass 42-inch TV that I'm paying a lot of money for and all that. But on the other hand, if I watch them on speed, I'm getting the cut up version where they're inserting commercials and making it fit in an hour and everything else.
Yeah. So, I mean, MotoGP.com is nice, because you can at least plug that into your monitor, even though the quality isn't going to be as good. But that's how we watch it. We watch it on TV.
I don't care. I mean, I just want to watch it then, especially when it's a really crucial deciding race. Yep. I want to see it then.
And I'm surprised that they don't do that. I mean, it's got to be a moneymaker for MotoGP. They've had their hiccups and bumps and whatnot in the road of bandwidth and everything else, but they seem to have gotten it down pretty well. And it ain't cheap. I mean, it's not as bad as, it's not super, super expensive, but it's not bad. You know what I'm saying? It's got to be a moneymaker.
Yeah. I mean, if you break it down per race, I would pay the exact same thing that I paid at MotoGP.com to WorldSBK.com.
Oh, sure.
No problem.
Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, Rally is one that I won't pay for, because it's like too insanely expensive for what I'm going to get out of it. I'm not that big of a Rally fan, but MotoGP is well worth the money.
Yep. Sure. All right. So listener emails. Jules, we got set straight by Mr. Kropotkin, David Emmett.
We did. Why don't you read that email from him?
Hayden didn't come in to – okay. So this is regarding our last episode, our anniversary episode, as it were. Number 200, Hayden didn't come in to repair his bike at PI, Phillip Island, because he was helping at my rain, and they showed the white flag, which was entirely feasible. If that had happened, Hayden could have come in and swapped bikes. If he'd already been in for running repairs, he would have handed the guys ahead of him a minute or more, which we would never been able to make up. Plus, a little bit of extra stuff here, Spies in Valencia. The rules are fairly clear. Each rider has 5 engines for last 7 races, which I'm still not sure if that's that was me speaking. That includes wildcard riders. So in theory, Spies could run through 5 brand new engines at Valencia, 1 for each session. In reality, he'll take whatever Yamaha give him, and Yamaha will give him something which keeps him out of the way of Rossi and Lorenzo. I don't know if I totally agree with that last part, at least, about the engines.
The part where Yamaha will give him what keeps him out of the way of Rossi and Lorenzo, is that what you're not agreeing with?
Yeah. I mean, they're going to want him to shine, I think.
He's just coming off of the championship. It'd be nice to have. You know, I was kind of floating that idea around where wouldn't it be nice if they could take away that legend of Troy Bayliss?
Yeah.
You know, he comes, wins the World Superbike Championship, comes to Valencia, wins the last race.
Yeah, but
the thing is that,
Rossi has won more races for Yamaha than anybody else ever. We saw all the statistics, right?
Yeah.
So I have to agree on that point that basically Spies is not allowed to beat Rossi.
Well, I don't think he's coming in to beat Rossi, but I think they want him to be. I think they would be quite happy to have him be mixed in among the aliens, as it were.
Yeah, I can see that. I can see him even being somewhat of a spoiler between like Rossi and Lorenzo, Rossi and anybody else. But the final outcome will be Rossi is ahead of Spies. That's I honestly, if they had the control, if they had the remote control that turned off Ben Spies' motorcycle at the right point, that's what would happen.
Except that, you know, that's a very dangerous strategy, because Rossi does not do well at Valencia.
This is true.
I know.
Which means that they could then, you know, hobble Spies.
I know, but I'm just kind of wondering.
And neither does the Yamaha. The Yamaha also has trouble at Valencia.
Why?
I don't know, but it's neither rider has been able to do very well at Valencia over the last couple of years, I've noticed.
But do you think that's going to be this way this year?
We'll see.
Yeah.
Do you think it's a bike like for as a classic example, the GSVR sucks at Phillip Island, and it always has, because you know, long turns, you know, laying on its side. But it's not the track. The track is not that unusual.
Yeah. I mean, it has a. I don't know. I mean, maybe it's because it's all mid gear corners. You know,
that could be okay. So maybe a torque issue in the mid range. I'll buy that.
Yeah.
Okay.
I somewhat think it remains to be seen, based on the improvements and everything that Yamaha has made and all of that, of whether or not Yamaha is going to do all that well at Valencia, whether Rossi's going to overcome the history that he's had there. But I do stand by that initial thing that if Yamaha had their druthers, so to speak, that they would druther that Rossi beat Spies.
Interesting. I mean, I think the biggest danger is actually just that the race is going to suck.
Right.
Because we had professionals there like 3 years in a row. I think the last time that we had a good race was when Nicky and Melandri in 2005 were fighting for the win, and Rossi was way behind him in third, and they had that last corner battle with Melandri and Hayden.
Yeah.
Melandri beat him. That was a really good race. But
yes,
since then, I don't remember anything except, you know, the 125s.
I think that they've been somewhat semi-disappointing. I mean, it's just like, but you know, you're talking 2005, different bike.
Of course.
A lot of stuff.
That's what I'm saying. It's like that was the last time that I remember a good race in Valencia for the premier class.
Yeah, I agree.
Well, sorry, 2006 was a good race. What am I talking about? 2006 was a good race. It had a lot of interesting things happen in it, obviously.
Well, it did, and it made a difference in a lot of point situations. And, of course, you had Bayliss, like, knocking the ball out of the park. But 2006 actually didn't really – wasn't that great race. What was it I said – was it last week I mentioned that? I'm like, Valencia is just kind of seeming like the best after party in racing.
Yes, exactly.
But on the other hand, and we'll talk about it soon, or we can talk about it now. We still have a championship yet to be decided there.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. So actually, let's keep piling through these listening emails because we've got a whole bunch of them.
And David, great friend of MotoGPOD and gentleman that runs MotoMatters.com. Thank you very much for that email.
Yeah. Thanks. Always.
Our friend Martin Darlington has two things that he sent us. One was actually he sent us a while ago, but we actually asked about it on the show. Like, you know, would somebody come up with a spreadsheet that shows all the different nationalities that have been in the premier class? And Martin did. It's really actually quite interesting.
Yeah, and Martin is the man, man. you ever get a chance to show up on my doorstep, I'd happily buy you a beer. It is a very cool chart, and we'll link to it. There are two things that struck me out of this. I'm going to describe the chart for the listeners. It's 2000 through 2010 projected, and it describes the nationalities over this span of riders in MotoGP, but specifically ones that scored points. So there may have been ones that were outside of that sphere, but we don't actually have this in here. But the thing that really hit me, Jules and Bob, was how prevalent and overpowering back in, you know, like 2002 through 2004, or 2000 through 2004, how many Japanese were in the series. I didn't even realize it until I started thinking about it because it just didn't stand out in my mind. And a lot of people always say, you know, the Italian, the Spanish, they like rule the thing. And they are now to some extent. But back then, it's not that long ago, that wasn't the case.
They were dominating in numbers of riders that scored points. It's huge looking at this.
Well, they had a lot of wild cards who scored points, but still, yeah.
Right.
We'll link to this, and I think folks will kind of find it interesting, and it's a really fun way to kind of break down things that you'll have a lot of people have preconceptions and only can focus on what is happening now as opposed to what has happened in recent years, and I would like people for the most part to not do that because you need to realize a little bit of the history and even a recent history. People blame FIM and Dorna for, you know, like kowtowing, and maybe they do for a bit to the Italian and Spanish side of the pond, but it's still a very diverse and has been a very diverse championship.
I mean, most of that is just out of the fact that those guys have the most riders that actually rise high enough to the top to be in the championship. Because I don't think that Dorna is turning away, you know, another Dutch rider or another, you know, German rider if they could get one of the caliber to ride those bikes. So at that level.
Right.
Well, and I think on top of that, Jules, it's the development program. So
that's what I mean. The Italians and the Spanish have an incredible set of series that bring riders, young riders, up to the championship level,
mm-hmm.
world championship level.
On that same thing, the Italians and the Spanish have such an incredible feeder program. I thought the surprising numbers was the number of points scored by American riders over this time span.
Yeah.
When you look at the points, which, let's see, they came in on points fourth,
mm-hmm.
Which, considering their representation, I thought was pretty considerable, especially since MotoGP and motorcycle road racing in general is a virtually unknown sport in the United States.
Well, yeah. I mean, and it pretty much always has been.
Yes.
I mean, I started going to, and you can consider me an old man, if you will, but I've attended every GP with the exception of a couple of the recent ones, but I started at the beginning, back in 1988, Laguna Seca. There was hardly anybody there, and it got really bad in the early 90s. People don't really know, and it's sad because it's, as we know, it's friggin' awesome.
Right, and you don't want to be known as the place to go for a GP where it's not crowded, it's easy, it's great, et cetera, et cetera. Which is like, you know, now, right now, Qatar, China was like that. You know, it's that sort of thing where it's like, if you want to go to a GP and it's not crowded, go to Qatar. You know, and we don't want Laguna Seca and Indy to be that way. The attendance numbers are still good, but it's hardcore fans, very much so. I don't think there's much else going on. Even, you know, if you talk to average motorcyclists on the street, they're not going to know anything about who is Valentino Rossi, who is Nicky Hayden, those sorts.
Oh, they may have heard the names, but they will certainly not be able to tell you, you know, anything about the racing because they haven't seen it.
Right, right.
It's not shown enough.
And don't forget, I'm also thinking of motorcyclists in general, including everybody, including like the cruiser riders.
Sure, of course,
But I mean, I think that's part of what we're trying to do is actually bring it to more people.
Right.
And I think we're doing a pretty good job of that.
I think so too. All right.
Another from our very good friend Martin Darlington, who writes some prodigious emails of great volume. Another thing I'm curious to hear your thoughts on was mooted by a viewer during Eurosport's free practice commentary, and Messieurs Moody and Ryder didn't know the answer. This involved a scenario of, for example, Rossi being on his fifth and final engine of the start of, say, good Lord, Martin, the Sepang race weekend. He doesn't use a second bike to save the engine, as this would involve the penalties coming into play. On race day, as we saw, it's a wet race. What would happen if, during the race, a dry line appears and he comes in to change bikes? The rules state that as soon as the bike crosses the pit lane exit line, that engine is deemed to have been used and they... and yet they can no longer relegate him to the back of the grid as the race is already in progress. Only the manufacturer's penalty could apply, but this is more evidence that this rule is fatally flawed and possibly unworkable. Well, Jules and Bob, both of you guys know I've been saying since, what, 5, 6, 7 episodes ago, they're going to whack the rule or they're going to do something crazy to it.
This is another example of why it needs to be whacked, because this is an awesome point. It's an awesome point. Yeah. But I do think that in this particular case, that safety trumps all the other rules. And so I'm sure for safety reasons, they would let that go. But it's a great point.
Yeah.
The thing is I'm not so familiar with all the entire rule book that I know this for a fact, but there's probably the other trumping rule that the stewards can decide whatever the hell they want on race weekend. And so that's why there's always these delays where you get the little scroll across the bottom, you know, race direction is figuring stuff out.
Yeah.
And on this particular one, I predict that we will see exactly what has happened in Formula One, where this rule is tweaked and tuned to the point of stupidity, that like, okay, oh, because Martin's email kind of went on about what if they don't show up on Friday afternoon for practice session because they already have enough data for that track and this and that, that we're going to see tweaking and tuning going on. And in that particular instance, what I figured is that they'll have a rule that says riders have to spend so many laps out per each practice session. And in this particular instance with the engine rule, they'll figure something out.
And then also force them to have a minimum lap time, because otherwise they'll just circulate really slowly and be very dangerous out there.
That,
I mean, it could get really insane,
like you say. Exactly. Hello, Formula One. Yep. You know, we've been preaching this for years, you and I, Jules, that these stupid rules that are kind of designed by committee and they sort of sound good on one level, maybe, but they're not really that great. And then you come up to that wall.
And this is why I think that Jim's prediction is going to come true, that basically by the time we start the next season, this is all going to get scrapped.
Well, the whole engine rule is going to get scrapped?
I don't think it'll be fully scrapped, but what I do think is that the MSMA, depending upon how much weight for example, a manufacturer like Suzuki has in it, who has already been screwed by it, will themselves petition to change it to something that's more reasonable, because I think they're friggin' nuts to try and do, what is it, six engines next
six
year?
Six engines for 18 races.
Yeah. That's insane. Yeah. That ain't going to work.
No, I agree. But the thing is the MSMA is largely ruled by Honda. So what Honda wants will go.
Well, yes and no. It is, but it also gains weight when you've got a manufacturer like Yamaha that is driving a lot of the things, and especially when both Yamaha and Ducati, and especially Ducati, if you think about it, who were bringing more bikes into the series, thank God, doesn't quite have the same sway. So I think the balance
of power.
Yeah, the balance of power may actually change a bit next year. And these are the guys that, you know, the whole reason for this end rule, if you think about it, is like, okay, we're going to juggle balls because the economy sucks. Well, if it's going to change, and it will change, we know it will change, why not make some allowances? I hope that happens, because the word I used was untenable in the last cast, and I still think that's applicable.
Yeah, I agree. And actually, what came to my mind as soon as you said balance of power was the Star Trek episode Balance of Terror.
Nerd.
Yeah,
I know. Sorry. Like Star Trek and MotoGP, he's not getting a date anytime soon.
Yeah, I think all of our female listeners are laughing.
Oh, they're done. They left a long time ago, Jim.
All right. Should I move? I'm doing pretty good reading these. You want me to continue?
Go for it.
Well, Bob, you need to do Gordon.
Okay, I'll do Gordon then. If I need to do Gordon. This is from
Gordon
Howe. Are you going to
do Gordon in as Gordon?
No, I'm not doing it as Gordon. But Gordon Howe from Pole Position Travel, which if you haven't checked it out, polepositiontravel.com, excellent place to go and check out how to see a race. And he corrected us on the exact time rule, or he informed us.
Well, he just reminded us. Yeah.
Yes. And he says, the exact time rule, in quotes, which meaning matching to the timing device's accuracy of a thousandth of a second, was invoked in the 2004 Qatar race where Lorenzo and Dovizioso, where Lorenzo was awarded the victory for the fastest lap time. I remember it well. I was there. Because this is in reference to the 250s finish at Estoril. Mike DiMeglio and Hector Barbera. Yeah, and it was like, you know, what happens? Come on, thousandths of a second? Who crosses the finish line the same time to a thousandth of a second as another rider? But you do have to prepare for that eventuality.
Yeah, and what was interesting about that particular race that Gordon mentions is that it was actually for the victory.
Yes.
That's the thing that was really amazing. Can you imagine that?
I know.
They had to go to the fastest lap to determine the victor.
Now, that was the one – was that the one where the photos – or no, that was even a different race. Remember the photos where the photo finish is like literally a tire width apart? Remind me which race that was.
That was
125s.
Yeah, that was 125s.
Yeah. Which was – it was like, oh, my God, you know, watching that. But, no, it happens.
It happened again at Sepang, and we will talk about it in a sec.
Exactly.
It's very relevant.
Yeah.
I guess we actually have some races to talk about, don't we?
We do. Yeah. We're going to have to plow through these emails. So.
Yeah. Wow. Jules, you're Polish, so I think you need to pronounce this name.
I was going
to
say. Karl Fortolotsky.
Nice.
He writes, just wanted to ask a quick question or make an observation. Would Ben Spies benefit from having a much more competitive team? Now, he wrote this before the World Championship was decided in World Superbikes. But anyway, would Ben Spies benefit from having a much, much more competitive teammate? Well, I understand that having a teammate that is too competitive, i.e. competing for the championship, Fabrizio and Haga, and obviously, this is me, Jules, Lorenzo and Rossi, could impede a rider's ability to win the overall championship. It seems to me that Sykes being such a non-factor makes Spieth's effort that much harder. Conversely, I do think that it, in some ways, having a teammate that isn't competitive highlights the talents of a, of certain riders like Stoner.
You know, and I thought about that. I read it, and I wondered if we were going to talk about this email, because I think we all know Sykes had a great BSB season last year, and to see him come in and not perform well on the R1 when Spieth obviously was kind of it almost casts a shadow on Tom. You know, because he couldn't do as well. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
He's still a great rider, a great racer, and it's kind of a shame. You know, and I'm totally excited about, well, and we'll talk about this shortly, that he was so overwhelmed by the phenomenon that was Ben Spieth.
In a way, you could also argue that maybe the R1 wasn't as amazing as everybody made it out to be. Now, it was really just Ben Spieth that made the R1 as amazing as it was this
year.
Much
like the Ducati in MotoGP.
With Stoner, exactly. Yeah,
you don't have to argue that. The R1 is not that great of a bike. I'm serious. Because it's not doing – it hasn't done that great in any other series.
It hasn't done that great in World Superbikes except for that one guy.
Exactly. But, I mean, we're talking national series all over the place. And there was one guy that brought it to prominence. And it's not easy to set up. You got to remember, you know, it's a totally new, you know, tweaky, you know, cross-plane crank engine that people haven't been able to figure out yet except for a very – close-knit team that managed to put it together.
Right.
Do you think that's a gift? Do you think that's like the Ben Spieth somehow is this magical marriage with the R1?
It's the team, Bob. Okay. So the fact that it's kind of like Jeremy and Valle. You had Tom and Ben and Woody. You had three guys that had worked intimately together for years, totally understood each other, and were able to put it together and drive it to the end.
Very cool.
Okay.
Yeah.
But to Cal's point, I think that you know, he was pointing out, and we will definitely talk about the whole points thing in Imola and the final race. But yeah, sometimes it can hinder you, and sometimes it's positive because you know you can always count on Fabrizio taking out getting in between the championship, the guy fighting for the championship, and somebody behind.
We did not plan that earlier before the call either. By the way,
you're a bad man, Jules. all right. Thank you, Cal. I appreciate it. And a final one, Jules. Did you want to just like that going to be a link for
basically, we've got a link in the show. I was not aware of this. There's a clip where Ben Spieth and Tom talk about the R1. And this was sent in by Fred Lindstrom and Tony Pags, who send me a lot of email all over in Facebook and to my email accounts and whatever. Great guys, very knowledgeable, very, very enthusiastic. So thanks, dudes. And we'll post a link to that because it's a very interesting, actually, set of information about DR1 and Wadsworth?
Yeah.
And the rest of the team did to the bike to make it a race-winning race bike.
Did you get mad because I was mocking you because you were the only race fan that didn't know about that yet?
Did you mock me about it?
Neither of you did?
No.
Oh, good Lord. You people don't get out enough.
You suck.
All right, moving on. You guys want to start with 125s?
Sure, yes. Let's go on 25s.
We'll just kind of, you know, rip through this because we already know that the championship is decided. I thought it was a pretty good race. The parts that I saw, I haven't watched the entire thing yet, but Simone Smith Espargaro, Gadea Toro Cortese Rabat, Inone Olivier, and Zanetti are your top 10. We had some guys fall out, including Marquez, which was kind of a drag.
Jim, I have to interrupt. Was that yes. actually 10 guys' names that you just read off right there?
It was.
It sounded like.
Yeah, do you have
I'm sorry to be a blur here, but it's like, a, wow. You know?
Marquez is very good at non-finishing races, actually. Right.
Well, yeah, he is. And he's still, if you think about it, he's more of a kid than some of the others.
Yeah, he's, I think he's 15 years old.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
and he's actually the height as if he was like 9.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, yeah. I think he comes up to like Pedroza's hip.
Simone and Smith had a great battle, and it was basically in a lot of ways a repeat of Australia because Smith led a bit, quite a bit of the race, and then started making mistakes, and he made a grievous mistake toward just a couple laps before the end, and then Simone basically got away from him. So he could never catch up. Espargaro, what happened with him? It's like starting with Indy, the guy is on fire. He's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. You know? Well,
he's on a good bike, but he wasn't really featuring in the beginning of the season.
And he is signed for next year on, I think, what is the name of the team? On one of the 250 or the Moto 2 teams. Yeah, crap, it evades me, but he'll be running there.
Cool.
Yeah. Our Moto 2 show, I've got so much stuffed into my head.
Mr. Spoiler.
Boy, Bob, did you hear about this? I totally screwed Jules over.
Jim and I were IMing pretty much all night through all the racing, and Jim could not wait until the World Superbike races were on TV. So he was basically watching them by looking at the times on the timing screen that World Superbikes provides.
Very, very confusing.
Yeah. And then he just says, oh, Haga just bombed it. Thanks, Jim.
I'm sorry.
But I still watched the races and it was,
Well, yeah, and you were pissed. I think you sent me something. I'm signing off. I am now.
Right.
You and I both have the same rules about spoilers, which is don't friggin' spoil it or I'm going to kill you. I felt really bad. Right? And I'll tell you that now. And you and I haven't talked about it, but yeah, no, I felt bad to do that because I thought you were still paying attention, and I didn't know.
I thought you were paying attention, Jules. I was too down.
Yeah, I was ready to go into an internet blackout. You just beat me to it.
Yeah, no, so my bad. And cool. Had I known, I would not have done so because I am one of those people that just frankly hates being spoiled for a race and will black myself out all the time trying to wait to see what's going on. So. I apologize.
Apology also, accepted. I'm the same way. So, when I completely off the internet on the weekend, that's why.
Yeah.
All right. Best race of the season.
Best race of the season.
Well, not the season, maybe, because we've had some great racing this year, but definitely one of the best 250 races and definitely the best race of the weekend.
Yeah.
250 race.
Walk us through it.
Well, let's see. So Aoyama, entire weekend, was looking really good. We got to remember that Simoncelli pulled himself within 12 points after Australia, where Aoyama did not do well. And we had that crazy thing happen at the end where he was fourth, but we had a crash. Locatelli crashed, and we had to go back to the previous lap results, and he lost 3 spaces because of that, and that allowed Simoncelli to pull within 12 points, which is still pretty hard, but no, Simoncelli has been having such an incredible run.
Definitely doable. Definitely. I mean, 12 yeah, points. Totally. Oh, yeah.
I mean, that's one win for Simoncelli and a third place for Ayama, and then a win in a second place, and that's it, you know?
Right.
So,
And we never see Simoncelli just half try.
Exactly. 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 And that was very, very much the case here. So Ayama was on pole, and he was the fastest man in all the sessions. It was obvious that he had the best pace, but very much like what Rossi did to Stoner in 2008, Laguna Seca, Simoncelli knew that if he could get in front of Ayama and stay and prevent Ayama to be in front of him in the sections where Ayama was fastest, that he could, you know, he could squeak out that win. And it's exactly what he was doing. It was basically since word go, first of all, Ayama did not have a good start. He went a little bit wide in I think turn three and lost a couple of places. And then, you know, by that point, you had, he was behind, I think, Willerott and Fabel and Barbara.
But Jules, your namesake was doing it.
That's right. And Jules Cluzel, that's right. Let's not forget Jules Cluzel. It's easy to forget him because he never finishes races, but he was the guy. He was the guy who actually had the whole shot.
Yeah.
And he stayed ahead for a really long time. It was getting kind of scary because he was definitely riding on the edge.
I was amazed. Yep. It's like, is that blank motorcycle? Is that Jules Cluzel?
Yeah. Sepang is a track where you expect a guy like Cluzel to last one lap because the moment they hit those two straights, it's over. But that wasn't the case at all. He was really just wringing everything out of there, and where they could pass him, if they could pass him on the straights, he just got past him right back in the first corner. That crazy little S chicane, and he kept coming back in there. It was amazing.
Well, as far as I know, too, and which is even stranger if you consider it, and it makes you wonder about some of the tuning that's being done as this season winds down. Is that he's not on an RSA? He's on an LE, which is an Aprilia LE as opposed to the RSA, which is the full factory bike. And it's not supposed to be that fast.
Right. Right.
So I would almost term it shocking in a way that he can do. And apparently the wrenches in his pits and paddock are doing what they can to put him up there. But you're right. He's totally riding on the ragged edge. And the thing that was so worrisome about Sepang was you see the top two guys trailing him. You know, for nine laps and just waiting for him to do something bad and take either one of them out.
Right, right. And ruin the championship.
Yeah.
Despite the fact that he didn't finish this race and didn't finish other races where he was leading, because he's riding on the edge. It did get him very much noticed. I mean, he looks like a good, very likely to get a ride with the Tech 3 Moto 2 team, which would be a score because those guys are definitely going to be one of the top teams.
I think of note is actually the people before we run down the results too. But we should definitely talk about some of the things that happened during the race because they were exciting. The people had dropped out of this race. You had not only Cluzel, you had DeRosa, you had Pacini, which is a big deal considering how well he was doing at the time. Domeglio, which was basically Simoncelli's speed bump, hopefully, for Bautista, who also dropped out. And it was kind of a mess.
Yeah, you have an interesting note there next to Bautista.
Well, he screwed up his season.
Yeah, he really did.
Potential for, Alberto, you know, finish.
Yeah, we were talking about this last week that he should not be so much concerned about catching the guys in front, but being caught from behind by Barbara, which of course now happened because he didn't. Because Bautista didn't finish the race, and Bautista, finished much higher. But I think that, but really the highlight of the race was once Cluzel did go off. No offense. And we got that incredible fight with Simoncelli and Aoyama. I mean, I don't think I've ever seen Simoncelli throw so much at a rider and the rider just refusing to buckle, especially Aoyama, who doesn't really ride a very aggressive. He's not a very aggressive rider. He's a very precise rider. He's very fast. He's wily, but he's not. He doesn't duke it out, and he was really not letting Simoncelli pressure him.
No.
Yeah, I think the IMs that you and I were trading back and forth. I think I probably said to you, Jules. I said he's friggin' pissed off.
Yeah.
Especially after he got nudged out at the classic corner 15, and pretty much almost put in a pit wall.
Right. Right.
And not only was
classic Simoncelli actually also
and not only was he pissed, but his crew was pissed, and so from then on, it seemed like he was just balls out.
He was on. Playing.
Yeah, he was on.
He was on. He was on. He was riding. He was running a very aggressive race, but also smart. He rode smart because everybody knew that he had the pace to. That once he got in front of Simoncelli for, in the section where Simoncelli can't draft him, that he would be gone.
Yeah,
and he finally came into that section where I think three laps in a row he had passes at one and repassing at two and repassing at three, and finally. Aoyama he stuck it out on turn four. It was really very, very aggressive maneuver, and then that gave him the lead in the section where he's really fast. He was able to pull a little bit of a gap on Simoncelli, and then he was gone.
Yeah, I think the term is he rode like a man possessed after that, and he simply determined that he was going to win the race and he was going to do it by whatever means necessary, even if they were the same ones that Marco had employed against him. And it was great. It was fun to watch.
Dishing it out. It was great.
That was totally an edge of the seat race. And I was loving it all the way. I mean, literally jumping up and down out of my seat.
Yeah, even my usual crew who don't follow 250s, my wife and my son were very, very much following that line.
that was the 250 race of the season that you had to watch. 250s had some fantastic races this season, but I think that one was really, really special.
Yeah, so
and let's also mention the end, because now so we basically got Aoyama leading, Simoncelli in second, and Barbara just sitting there behind Simoncelli, looking like he just barely can keep up with Simoncelli, and that meant 5 points.
Yeah.
But Barbara was saving his last little bit of a lunge for the last lap, and we had another. One of those less than one thousandth of a second photo doesn't tell us anything finishes where we had to go to the fastest lap, and that was not Simoncelli.
Yeah, and that is so. I mean, what are the odds of having that twice in 1 year? And it was like, you couldn't split a tire whisker on seeing that.
The camera angle I thought was a bit weird because.
A little diagonal.
Yeah, right? It was a bit diagonal, and it was like, wow. But then they showed another shot, and it's like, wow. They, they're crushing.
Yeah, the actual finish line camera, which is shooting directly right in front of the finish line, and there is nothing separating those guys.
No.
Zero.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
As Barbera came to drafting Simoncelli and passed him and all of that, it was just – it was amazing. He's coming up on the finish line and everything. And I think Simoncelli thought he had it.
Yeah.
That was like, wow, look at that. And
that's another 4 points right there. So,
yeah. 8 points if you go by Nick Harris's math.
That's right.
Nick and math, not a great combination.
I was like, I'm trying to, it's like, okay, that sort of makes sense.
But it makes sense for if you're talking about the two leaders, not Barbera. Yeah, and I was Shelley. Like,
what? Well, and so look at what we got. I mean, we're going the one championship that's waiting to be crowned, right? This year is 250s.
Yep.
And so we're heading in with what, a 21
points.
21 points.
Yep.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's basically the kind of race where it's going to be Ayamas to lose.
Yeah.
But you know.
And hopefully we don't see what we saw in World Supers, which we'll get to in a minute. Because I was a little disappointed reading the blurbage from race two of World Supers. I don't know. I don't. In some ways, it's like it's so great to see a championship finish this way, where it's right down to the wire. But in other ways, it's like they're now all of a sudden this strategy comes in, of like all I have to do is circulate, and that's always a little disappointing.
Right. Right. Well, you know, I wouldn't be very surprised if that's what would happen, because with a guy like Simoncelli still in the running, you probably wouldn't want to be too near him.
I agree, especially after seeing that. I mean, that, you know, they called it a racing incident and all that, but Simoncelli, you know, he ran Ayama off the track. And
this, you know, I mean, he's been warned, he's been fined, he's been, right. You know, it's
on the other hand,
a very aggressive rider.
Yes, that particular incident that we're talking about here was impossible to call. What are you going to say? Oh, you can't ride that aggressively. You know,
he drifted wide because he was entered the corner too fast, right. And you know, and there happened to be a guy there.
Right, exactly. Simoncelli could have intentionally done that. You know, but it's those are the kind of things where you can't call it.
Right, but we know.
Yes, we do.
We can't call it, but we know.
That hair tells you.
I have to say that Simoncelli was very, very cool. He always is a very cool guy during the interviews. He's one of the funniest
podium, yeah.
accents. His podium interview was his interview afterwards was really, really good stuff. It was good stuff.
All right, so the boring race in the Premier Series.
Bit of a disappointment.
Well, yes and yes no. And we no. did. We did crown.
Yeah, I think even Rossi would.
Well, wait. This was a very interesting race, just not the racing part of it. But one of the most interesting things was, I've never seen this before, was that the riders took out an extra lap to go around. And that's apparently it's totally fine, yep. As long as the pit lane's open.
You're right. And you and I, again, we're IMing about that back and forth, because both of us were kind of freaking out about what Lorenzo was doing, because he had major problems with his bike, right? And so they did, you know, okay, let's back up a little bit. 125s and 250s were run in beautiful, perfect conditions, but this is a pang, you know? Yeah,
exactly.
And you never know what's going to happen. And it's really funny. Just before it started raining, Jules, I actually typed in but didn't hit send something that, along the lines of the clouds look threatening.
Oh, and I turned to my wife and said, man, it looks dark.
Yeah, yeah. And next thing you know, they're showing pit lane, and it's hammering down. And nobody was prepared for that. And all of the practice up to that point had been in the dry. So they had no experience with wet. Now, granted, okay, it's Sepang. They have experience in the wet. They have data for that. Mm-hmm. But it's clearly not on the chassis and motors that they have now and the electronics. So what do they do? The people can adapt the fastest and dial it down to whatever the softest both torque and suspension settings are the quickest are the ones that are going to do well. And the teams that have that capability of doing that quickly and not screwing something up. So we ended up with a wet start, and it was delayed by what, 45 minutes?
It ended up being only 35 minutes. They first it was 45 minutes, and they changed that because they started realizing that with the weather being so unpredictable, they might as well just go with the rain, you know?
Yeah, well, and in fact, it ended up being perfect because it continued to rain through the entire race because none of us like these wet-dry races or dry-wet races where you got to bring the bike in and swap them out. That sucks. You want to see something continuous, something linear.
Right.
And so we had a race that was straight on, you know, sprinkling all the way through. Tires didn't shag off. And that was good. But just the shock of that after a completely dry weekend was really weird.
Yeah, it was really very, very strange. I think it's everybody by surprise. People got, I think, a little bit frazzled, and none more than Lorenzo, who hopped on his first bike and had some issues getting it rolling. So he went on the second bike, went out there, did a couple of laps, did the first lap, then the second lap, and then decided to come back into the pits. But he ran out of time, and the pits were now closed. And the penalty for doing that is you get to start at the back of the grid.
Right. This is something we should have mentioned at the beginning because it was a little bit puzzling when you're watching the race on speed, for instance, of why that happened.
So they didn't talk about that on the speed broadcast?
Not much. No, they just said they have the Nick Harris broadcast and all that, and Lorenzo's going to be starting at the back of the grid because he did not grid in time.
Oh, wow. Yeah. So he basically went out for the same two laps that everybody else went, except that he came back after instead of gridding because he wanted to switch the bikes again or do some kind of adjustment.
Yeah, I think there was a whole bunch of confusion about what you could and couldn't do, and I don't think any of that was really clear. Because both you and I, Jules, were surprised when Rossi and a couple other guys cruised through the pits after the first warm-up lap and then cruised back out again. And while the other guys were gridding up, we're like, oh, we didn't know they could do that. But hey, that's pretty smart to do.
Yeah. For several reasons. One is because you get to really get a look, maybe to try two different lines when you're going through various corners, but also keep your tires a lot warmer because you're going to be sitting on the grid a lot shorter.
Yep. And so I was, there's a lot of race savvy being shown. And I think there was also a fair amount of coattailing on Valet during that period of time because you saw, I think it was Toslin came in behind him. Elias, and I'm like, oh, they're either following the leader, which clearly he is, or they know as well. But it was odd. It was really odd.
And we forgot to mention that Rossi was on pole.
Oh, yeah.
And that he basically owned the entire weekend, pretty much, with the exception, I think, of warm up, right?
Yeah,
which went to Stoner. Anyway, so we have the two guys that actually can make a difference in the championship: Rossi starting from spot one, and Lorenzo starting from the very, very back.
But he originally qualified in what, fourth?
Yeah,
yeah. So he would have been right there. And, you know, that was his opportunity. And this pre-race foo-faraz, what, frankly, kind of skittled his season as well.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it actually, that whole mess was kind of like what the season was like for him in a lot of ways. And another thing that was interesting was that he left it all open for Caparossi to just fly through.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know? The Caparossi didn't have anyone in front of him. Anyway, so then we have the race start, and surprise, surprise, Pedroso is in the front. But Rossi had he actually didn't have a bad start. He just he was really trying to get in front of Pedroso, so he went late on the brakes and realized, oh, that's right, I forgot, it's raining or something. and he went deep.
I was always wondering about that, how the whole thing, that there was some weird sort of let Lorenzo catch up thing or something going on. It was bizarre.
You thought he did it on purpose?
I don't know. That's the thing. I was watching it, and that thought entered my mind was of that he wanted to be battling with Lorenzo.
And no.
I think you're nuts.
because the thing is, like, he was going to expect Lorenzo to do what Lorenzo did. I mean, Lorenzo, meanwhile, came from the back, ended up, I think, in 10th on the first corner. And by the time they went through turn four, he was in front of Rossi, wasn't he?
Yeah, well, there was a really good bit that Colin Edwards did with Gavin Emmett. You know how they do every week, yeah. The track walk, as you will, or the track ride. And he's talking about how, you know, this is a Formula One track, you know, where they like bring people down to first gear and basically park them, you know, for a little right. exhibition. And the same thing happened in the first corner, which in the past, as we well know, at Sepang has produced some really crappy events where people that you would expect that would be near the front have been knocked out. And we were glad we didn't have that, especially on a wet track, because it could have been even worse. But yeah, it was a big mess. And the wide line that Valet took was odd, but it really didn't hurt him that bad in the end. And I'm certain that he didn't do that, you know, the go hang back with his teammate.
It was just, I agree, but it was just so unusual to see, you know, that he lost so much in that.
Well, I mean, it was just a mistake, but a mistake when everybody is that close means you're going to lose not like, I mean, he lost a little time, but he lost a lot of spots.
Yeah.
You know, because it's right at the very start of the race and, you know, everybody's going past it. So yeah, and we came out of the first lap with Stoner leading, because he managed to get past Pedrosa, and then we didn't get to see much Stoner after that because he just was on a completely different pace than everybody else. He has nothing to lose, and he's, you know, got the skill to actually, you know, say, okay, I'm just gonna go.
Nobody told him it was raining is what the problem was.
What's that?
Nobody told him it was raining.
Pretty much.
I think the term that you're looking for is checked out.
Yes, exactly. He checked out.
Yeah. Which kind of created a bit of a snooze fest at the front, but there was a lot going on in the middle of the race.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We had a great battle with Nicky Hayden and Lorenzo. Because Lorenzo, when he got past Rossi, then Hayden was ahead of him. Hayden was just not going to let him by easy, and he didn't. They had a good battle for at least two laps. Lorenzo finally got past him. We had Dovizioso was having a fantastic run chasing Pedrosa. So we had Stoner, Pedrosa in second, and Dovizioso in third. Lorenzo in fourth for a while, and then Rossi started to crank it up.
But until Dovi.
Well, yeah, Dovi eventually, you know,
tossed it.
Yeah, he tossed it out. Well, that was towards the end. But before that, you know, Rossi was already starting to set the fastest laps of the race.
And Dovizioso's effort was impressive because he gridded up at 11th.
Yep. Yep.
And in fact, Bob, your favorite whipping boy, RDP, was first out.
Yes, he was.
That's right. That's right. And He was shown quite a few times without his leathers.
I know.
Yes, yeah. Very, very sweaty and bare chested. Well done.
Yeah. Happy birthday, Grace.
No, I mean, very fun race, but near the end, as I guess we all know, it got spread out enough, you know. Poor Danny, and I actually felt for him during this thing, was like all by his lonesome.
Well, he wasn't. He was getting caught by Dovizioso. Dovizioso then tossed it out.
Well, yeah. But I mean, 12 laps after that, mm-hmm. you know, the guy's like, you know, just circulating. And, you know, Casey was what, 10, 12, 14 seconds ahead of him? I mean, that, you know, that can't be fun. And it's really hard to hold your pace when you can't measure yourself against somebody else, when you're only measuring yourself against a clock.
Well, you know what? Those are the two guys that do it very well, because Casey Stoner and Danny Pedrosa love to be in the front and just run away with it. The only reason why Pedrosa hasn't been able to run away with it that much this year is because the Honda has been not as good as
true.
It has been previous years relative to the other bikes.
Very true.
So I think that Danny Pedrosa is very good in that. I think he probably prefers it to dicing with people. I mean, he's not a dicer. He's not really that kind of a guy who, I don't think he gets a thrill out of passing and all that kind of stuff.
You say something like that, the hairs on the back of my neck stick up, and I'm like, well, screw that, dude. You got to dice. that's what this game is all about.
It's true. It's a fact.
Let's run down, Bob, why don't you run down through the finishing order.
Finishing order on MotoGP was Casey Stoner winning it, which a relatively boring race because he checked out and won it by what? 14.666 margin.
Ah, the mark's the devil.
Yes, right. Exactly. The mark.
And it would have been more. He actually tuned it down a little bit towards the end.
Yeah, he had a huge, huge lead. It was just stupid. Pedrosa finished second, and Pedrosa had a big margin back to third was almost 5 seconds, and then Valentino Rossi finishing on the podium, which was cool because you know we knew this was the one where he's going to cinch championship and all of that, but I don't know, you know, finishing on the podium,
I think given that how well he was riding the entire weekend, he was disappointed probably, but. You know, he won the championship.
Exactly. Who's going to remember?
And on top of that, I think the most important thing that Valle had to do this weekend, besides winning the championship, was to finish ahead of Jorge.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Right. Yeah. He probably did want to finish in front of Jorge. Very, very true.
Right. Yeah. And he did that. Jorge came in fourth. It's a fair gap back to from Rossi. Final spot was what, 6.5 seconds. So that's a ways back. Fifth spot went to Nicky Hayden. Very good race that Hayden ran. He gridded up. Where did Hayden grid up? He picked up a couple spots. And I think he gridded up seventh.
I think that's right.
Yeah, if I'm not correct. Yeah, exactly, seventh. And picked up a couple spots, ran a good race, et cetera, et cetera. Good stuff. Sixth went to Christopher Mühlen, our rain expert. Who picked up a lot of spots because he gridded up in 14th.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, he did a very, very good race.
Tony, and he actually had to fight for them. He didn't, like, get them all in the first, you know, corner.
Right.
Like,
no, he. It was a steady progression through the race, and I thought he did pretty good. Tony Elias in 7th, which he gridded 6th, so he, you know, finished similar. Marco Melandri, our shining star this season, of, you know, send the guy out on last year's bike, finished 8th. And speaking of picking up spots, he gridded 15th.
Yeah. You okay there, Bob?
Yeah, I'm doing good. Sorry, dude. A little bit of a hiccup thing going on. Thanks for bringing that to everybody's attention, Jules. 9th spot went to Loris Caparossi. Loris had an interesting race. Not all that necessarily good because he actually lost spots, but whatever. Finished 9th. Mickey Callio 10th. Is that?
Aleix.
I was just going to say, how do you pronounce that?
Well, you weren't around when Len Padilla sent us a really nicely recorded clip.
Oh. Yes.
So, of how this pronounces it. So now we all know. Aleix Espargaró.
It's Aleix Espargaró.
You're not rolling your R's well enough.
No, I'm not.
Espargaró.
Yeah, okay. It's just going to have to do. So, he finished up at 11th. 12th, Alex De Angelis, which I hope I said that okay. 13th, disappointment of the weekend, Colin Edwards. Now,
especially because Dovizioso didn't finish. That's the biggest of a disappointment because he's fighting for that fifth spot. This was the opportunity to
pick up the points and nail it and all that. Yeah.
Yeah, he got 3 points
in the championship. Got it. You know, oh man, I'm dying to get fifth in the championship. Everybody remembers that. Poor Colin. But no, didn't have a very, very good race. I have not read any blurbages of why or what.
Well, in the press release, he just says the usual, like, yeah, just things just weren't working.
Yeah, yeah, they weren't working. Yeah, they sucked. 14th, Galvik Tamaki. 15th, James Toslin, speaking of sucked. And so he picked up 1 point.
So James, what did happen to James? He didn't have another right through, did he? Sorry.
No, he gridded 14th. So, you know, finishing 15th is okay.
But he was 35 seconds behind Tomasi.
I know.
I'm pretty sure half of his mind was already in Portugal.
That's brutal. Good chat.
But I'm assuming that he went off at some point. He had a little bit of off track. We just never saw it.
Hear about it, yeah. Because I mean, basically, the Rossi celebrations were like over and shit by the time he finally crossed the finish line. So
yeah, and he was 35 seconds back from Tomasi.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I was 150 behind Stoner, so it's like almost 2 minutes.
Weak.
And not classified, Andrea Dovizioso, as we talked about, and Rende de Punier, as we also talked about, which, you know, bringing up my prediction for the man, that he's a bit of a crasher.
You know, me and Jules are going to keep beating you up about that. I know,
and that's fine. I don't care. I really don't, honestly.
I think he's worked really hard this year.
He did very well this year.
But I also think that he probably would have been finishing better if he had been riding his usual style. I just think he knows that he's not going to be getting rides in this economy if he keeps crashing bikes.
Being French only goes so far.
and the fact that, you know, like in a crash you could lose an engine, which is now really, really, really valuable.
Well, looking at the thing, he only failed to score points in two races this year.
Right.
That is like an RDP record. So, you know, I think he's done quite well. He's not going to be winning any championships anytime soon. But on the other hand, you know, you can somewhat count on him to at least finish.
Yeah, no, and he had some really good finishes,
he
too.
He did.
Although towards the end of the season, he kind of started to drop off.
A little bit, yeah.
And I think it all happened after – what was the previous crash?
Germany.
In Germany, right? Okay, yeah. I think that after that,
he picked up his highest point scoring finish in Britain at Donington right after Germany, and then
yeah, but that was a wet race. That was a wet race. Defend.
Yes,
that was a sloppy race.
That one was a bizarre non sequitur of a race that didn't really have a lot of bearing on the rest of the season. But it is interesting. He took a fourth there. And third, excuse me.
Yeah, he was on the podium.
Yeah, he was on the podium. So good for RDP. But from there.
I like that. But that, yeah. Yeah. I agree with Jules. I think he's had a great season. So good
Ross
Lord.
Celebrations. Before we go.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. We have to talk about those. So I was expecting a lot more. And the thing that popped into my mind as I was watching it, because, you know, Rossi has had some absolutely classic celebration, you know, Snow White and Seven Dwarves, all that stuff over the, you know, Claudia, all that stuff over the years has been very epic. But I think a whole bunch of it was dampened by the fact that we had crap weather.
You think so? Maybe. You think that was the only reason?
No, I think part of it is that it's just a lot funnier and a bigger deal to his close friends than it is to the rest of us.
Inside jokes. I tend to.
There's a lot of inside jokes.
Oh yeah, and this one certainly was, wasn't it?
Yeah. So
scrambling for translations.
Yeah, actually, I have a friend, my friend Dario Rossi, who used to be on RO2. Rossi non Valle Rossi, remember?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So he's Italian, and in case you couldn't guess from his name, and he always gives me translations from GP1 and, you know, other publications, Italian publications. Gives me all sorts of ridiculous rumors because he reads Italian press, and he So he translated the T-shirt and explained the whole chicken thing because they were talking about the literal translation, which is that an old chicken makes a good broth. But the implication is that the Italian saying basically means that the old chicken may not be able to lay any eggs, but at least it'll make a good soup.
Right. They actually mentioned that on the on Nick Harris and Kevin Emmett on the thing. They mentioned that on the Speed broadcast.
They didn't mention the part that doesn't like lay the eggs.
No, they did. I saw it.
So he explained it also in his PR release as well. The whole thing, but you know that's why they had the egg, and that's why they had the
right pork. Because it was still a bit of an inside joke. You know, an egg with a number 9 painted on it, and a little bit like, what the hell does that mean? And then when somebody explained it, it's like, oh yeah, I get it, but you really don't get it. You know what I mean? It's like,
I think you have to kind of have it built into the culture, right?
Right, right. Because I was thinking, well, that's a little lame. And
it was without a doubt an inside joke. And both you and I, Jules, were kind of like, okay, I'm trying to figure this out. And neither of us natively speaking Italian, but it was still kind of classic ballet.
Yeah.
You know, in its execution, as it were.
Oh, yeah.
And his victory lap or laps, I'm not sure if he took one or two, were just brilliant, and the crowd was going crazy. Very, very, very fun to watch. And, you know, if there's anybody that's fun to watch celebrating a championship, and we've seen it so many times, you know, it's number 9, it's Valentino Rossi.
Yeah.
Yep.
So, you know, and kudos to Valle for winning the championship. I think that he would have much rather preferred to win the championship with a win. But
oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. But, you know, he did, on the other hand, at least he, you know, got on the podium.
Right.
That would have been very embarrassing, which leads us into World Superbikes.
Played, Bob.
Like that. So I was really disappointed with the blurb from race 2 of this, and we're going to get into this in a second, from World Supers. I have to say I was almost a little bit disgusted with the comments that came from race 2 from the Yamaha team.
Interesting.
Okay. Yeah. I can't wait to hear what
why
the issue
I'm disgusted.
With. Yeah.
Well, let's run down it real quick. We're running really long here. We're at an hour and 15 odd right now. So,
Bob and Jules, let me ask you guys both a question. Has anybody ever complained that the podcasts were too long?
Yes.
Oh, yes.
Yes, they have.
Oh, yeah. All the time.
Okay. All of you people who think they're too long are lame.
People time it to their commutes, Jim. And yeah. It's like when you start running long and then the commute is over and then it's like they got to figure it. Yeah. But in any case, anyway, race 1 of World Super Dupers.
Before we even get to race 1,
okay.
I think that the biggest disappointment to me was the Super Bowl, because the Super Bowl basically set the stage for not a very exciting two races. Now, Jim did point out that the fact that turn 1 at Portimão is tricky as hell, and you can definitely gain a lot of ground that you may have not had on the grid.
Yeah.
So that kind of had my hopes up. Thanks, Jim, because that's not how it played out. But really, elbows really, man, did he? You have to say like. Maybe the results weren't that exciting in the end, but watching Vince Spies take off from the very moment the lights went out and just crank it and just take off was amazing.
He ran an excellent weekend.
Yeah, yeah, he essentially toyed with everybody in Super Bowl, and he didn't even use his last Q tire. If I understand what I've heard correctly. Which is amazing, the Q rear. Well, they don't really have Qs, but they do. But I think some of the other surprises were like Shaky Byrne being in second. I mean, that was a shocker.
It's not the first, by the way.
Yeah, Yeah, and you know, you had a couple of the other usual suspects, but you had guys who got dropped out, including Nari, who didn't make it into Super Bowl III.
Right.
Or Super Bowl. But that was an Americanism, wasn't it?
it was a miserable. I mean, the final, you know, grid positioning, Nori down in 10th, it was like, oh, that's not good. But yeah, there were some surprises up top. You know, Spieth taking pole, Shaky Byrne third, Shaky Byrne second, Fabrizio third, and Ray in fourth, which, yeah. Ray's, you know, Ray's been doing real, real well, but. It's just that Nori Haga way down in 10th. I mean, what is that? Third row on the grid in Superbike? Yep. Yeah, third row.
Yep.
Yeah, and we were all really worried, frankly. You've got 4-4-4 in Superbike. But
right.
We were all really worried that that Fabrizio and Ray would spoil the party, as it were.
Right.
And
not that, Fabrizio. That was,
well, yeah, and that was kind of everybody's biggest concern. And as it turned out, that wasn't the case, because when race one and lights turned green, Ben was gone.
Yeah, it was. That was exactly it. He just took off, and while, you know, Biaggi was able to stay with him and for quite a while. There was no way he was actually going to catch him. I think Ben went out there in front and was just controlling the race and making sure that the pressure was on everybody else to catch him.
Right. And there was a lot of comments in race two, which we want to get to, about the differences on the way the Yamaha handles the warmer track temperatures and all that, because the temperatures were vastly different between the two races. And he owned that first race.
He did.
And the second race, he looked like he was having troubles. I don't know.
I think it was a very calculating race. It's very hard to tell. But
well, that's what they said in press releases. But watching the race, I'm seeing his sliding and some troubles and stuff like that. And that was where I was a little bit puzzled, if you will.
Yeah.
Huh. I'll disagree. I think he was like running a relatively wise race in race two. I think that he did exactly what he needed to do, and he said as much. There's a great interview with Jonathan Green at On the Throttle TV, which we'll link to because it's a great one. He's sitting there sipping whiskey in his garage while he's talking to Jonathan, and then I had the opportunity this morning. Which was really cool to interview, albeit through email. I don't know if you've seen that yet, Bob. Nori Haga.
Oh no, I haven't seen that.
Yeah, no, it's pretty cool. But I think he was just pacing himself in race two. But we're kind of getting ahead of ourselves here. So let's walk through what happened in race one, because there were a ton of crashers.
Oh, it's crazy.
Especially one particular one.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, indeed. And let's just run through all the people that were out, because that was kind of nuts. And I'll go from first to last. Out Kageyama, Nieto, Haga, Inuzo, Guintoli, which was a drag, but he was fine. Jakob Smirts, who nobody should be surprised about. Leon Haslam, that was a bummer because he had a good run going. Troy Corser, I think that was a mechanical, was it not?
I think it was, yeah.
Yeah, and Mr. Resch on the TKR Suzuki from Switzerland. But running back down from top to bottom through the grid was Ben Spies, Johnny Ray, another great run. Max Biaggi, Shaky, Michel Fabrizio, Leon Camier. Excellent showing, and he had a great weekend on the second Aprilia, I think. And then moving even farther forward, Carlos Checa, who is moving to the Althea Ducati team and actually was testing on that in the last 2 days. Ruben Chaus, Michel Legrieve, Biacho. I'm probably going to get in trouble from that. I'm going to get a email from Pierre Francisco. Brock Parks, who I believe is going to 600s. Mr. Tomata, who is out. David Salome and David Checa, both from, or actually I think just David Checa was from GMT 94 French team, and Mr. Scassa. So we, you know, we had 15 guys for that range of points, and that's kind of a, you know, that's not kind of the field that you expect to finish. I mean, we have what, eight or nine guys out.
Right. Exactly. A lot of guys out. It's just insane in World Series. Not what you see.
Yeah. But then, so what does that create? Well, it creates an atmosphere that we're really looking forward to, which is race two, right?
Well, do we actually talk about the fact that Haga crashed?
Probably meant.
Well, yeah. So for the people that weren't paying attention, Haga crashed.
Yeah. Like lap six or so, just.
Yeah, and he was basically the entire weekend he was having trouble with the bike setup and the tires specifically.
Was he not and also he sick, choice. With, or was that last weekend?
No, that was. I don't think Haga's been sick in a while.
No, he had the flu.
I'm with Bob. I heard that he had the flu
and this weekend. I think it was this weekend. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah, well, so blame the wife.
But he had a miserable qualifying session.
Well, he had two sets of tires to choose from, and everybody warned him that the hard set of tires that he was picking was going to give him the turning that he likes. He you know, I think I've mentioned this before, but there was some I forget who rode his bike. I think it was a journalist that knows how to ride and was writing about it and saying that it was the most insane machine. It's the way it was back in the Yamaha days, that it was like he couldn't understand how it could be ridden at the pace that Haga rides at. And he likes very quick turning. That's why his lines are so much different than anybody else's. Anyway, everybody was warning him. Yeah, it'll give you the turning, but it's not gonna have the grip. It's an iffy tire. You're taking a chance, and sure enough. And you know, race two, he didn't run that tire.
Right. Because he basically crashed out on a relatively, you know, I'm not sure which corner it was in, but yeah, just low sided it down. Lost the front.
Well, that's the problem with Port Abel is that it's deceptive when you're watching. Every corner is dips and rises. I mean, it's such an incredibly undulating course that that particular corner he was coming down into the suspension was already compressed, mm-hmm. you know, and so there wasn't that much left. If he had to touch the brakes, which is probably what happened, and the tire didn't have all that much grip to begin with.
Left you nowhere to go. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. Basically, left nowhere to go.
Wow.
Yeah,
and it was just a shame because if he had finished, you know, in that fifth or sixth spot, we still would be talking about, you know, a few points here and there, and a real fantastic final showdown. But because he crashed,
right?
Spies was going to the last race with a 15-point lead,
and exactly, and that meant that. Nori had to podium, and Spies had to no finish just to pass him on points.
Right.
Well, yeah, I mean, frankly, Ben did exactly what he needed to do.
Exactly.
And that's how you play the game. You win when you have to, and you let the other person, or you lead the other person into playing your game. That's how racing works.
Now, on the other
And he also knew in race two that, you know, in race one he did get away. In race two he might not get away from guys like Ray and Biaggi who could spoil it for him.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, not Biaggi necessarily, but certainly Ray and Fabrizio.
Yeah. I mean, it really was a bit of a chess game that we were watching in all the races this weekend, frankly. Although it got in a really angry chess game in the 250 GP class, but and you saw that, and so you know, race two was pretty much straightforward. You know, Ben did exactly what he needed to do. He knew that if Nori finished first, that he'd have to finish sixth or better. So where did he settle in? Well, he settled in at sixth, playing around with Biaggi for the longest time until he kind of got wind that Biaggi wasn't going to play that game and kept wanting to pass him and let him go. And then he passed him back again and ended up in fifth.
And I think he did that because it looked like Noe was actually going to catch those guys in front. Noe started riding really good laps.
Yeah, you there's no doubt that you want to have a little bit of a cushion because you never know what's going to happen.
Right.
Yeah. The winner, who is kind of, you know, we kind of joshed about it earlier in the year, and probably I think a lot of this is simply because we were not necessarily doubting Fabrizio's skill, but we were kind of peeved that he always looked so out of control.
Mm-hmm.
He took the win. Yeah. And so Ducati, you know, granted they didn't win the championship, but they got a 1-2 with Michelle and Haga, and Johnny Ray got on the box again.
Yeah, but and there's been quite a bit of what ifs, because Fabrizio beat Haga at Imola in race 2, where it was already coming down to the wire with a championship, and a lot of questions asked about. Why are there not team orders between those two guys? First of all, I think that it's awesome that there aren't any team orders.
Yeah.
That's a huge kudos to Ducati for running their team that way, letting each rider ride their best. And second of all, like in this race in Valencia, like Fabrizio letting Haga go, I mean, they don't really know necessarily what's going on with speed. Well, Haga was really, as far as Fabrizio knew, Haga was in third place because Johnny Ray made a mistake on that last lap, which allowed Haga pass. There was no way Haga was actually going to catch him in that last lap.
Yeah.
So as far as Fabrizio was concerned, Haga was coming in third. There was no chance for anyone to actually let him know that Haga was in second, even if it had mattered. And it didn't, because even if he had let Haga win, that wouldn't have been enough.
Yeah, that was kind of a key point that I asked Nori this morning, and basically I asked him, there are many people arguing that Fabrizio should have dropped back, and this next sentence is really key because this is the one that I know he truly believes in, and my question was, now I know that you refuse to win a gifted title, mean being handed something that you know was based on team orders, but how do you feel about that? And what Nori said was, if you're talking about race 2 at Port Mile, it wouldn't have made a difference, Fabrizio dropping back. Ben had the situation under control and knew exactly what he had to do. Even if I had won that race, he would still have taken the title. And like I say, still Nori talking, like I say, from the beginning, I want to win the title by myself without help from others giving me points. If I had won it at Imola and then won the title, everyone would have said it was because Michelle gave me those points. And if I had won an Imola and not won the championship, everyone would say that I couldn't win even though Michelle helped me. So it's stupid. I love that. I love that.
That's great.
Yeah. This is racing, and this year Ben won. I did my best, and I'm satisfied that I can say that I always did my best. Now we work hard to fight for the title next year. And thank you to Heather Watson at Ducati PR for that. Really cool.
Very nice.
Yeah.
And this is why we love Haga.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Straightforward, no bullshit racer, but knows how to have fun.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
I think that's really important.
Yeah. I still have to say I'm a little disappointed he didn't win the championship, but I'm not alone on that one.
Well, I'm very disappointed that we didn't have a great, you know, two races, but yeah, whatever.
Yeah, race 2 wasn't bad. So,
so there was another championship decided.
Oh, indeed, there was.
Going into the final race of the year at Porto Mile, we had a pretty neck and neck battle with Eugene Laverty and Cal Crutchlow, and it was only those two guys that really had any shot at the top.
It's the final race in the World Super Sport Series, by the way.
Yeah. Basically, mathematically, it was just them. And Eugene had to win. We talked about this last week. And Cal Crutchlow had to come in, I don't know, it was like 13th, 12th. Yeah. Just needed.
Well, it was 18 points, right?
Yeah, 18 or 19.
19 points,
And Portimao is clearly, you know, Team Park Algar, which is the home circuit, the name of that track, he had to do what he could do. And so he won in a commanding fashion. And it was amazing. Cheers to Eugene. We'll be talking to him very shortly, I hope, before he scurries off and hides in the hinterlands, because I know he doesn't like to talk about racing when he's not actually racing. But Cal came home in fourth and kind of did a Ben race two, if you will, in that he was where he needed to be and take it. So congratulations to him for his World Super Sports Championship. And it's amazing if you think about it. Yamaha is kicking ass everywhere right now.
Right.
I mean, you know, you've got MotoGP. You've got World Superbike, World Supersport. I think their MX teams are doing the same thing. I mean, it's their year by far.
Right. And we were talking about it earlier, but you know, the R1 maybe not being the best bike, but it doesn't matter because the combination of the machines, the technology, the factory support, just the effort all around, of course, great riders. And this is definitely a Yamaha year, absolutely.
Yeah. With the one sort of lone and very weird if you will, guy that's running on, in theory, and I still think it's bullshit, an NSR 250R in 250s that we're waiting to see what happens.
Uh-huh.
I don't believe it. Well, there's so many people that say, you know, the thing's not built. Well, yeah, it is.
Yeah. Well, I think there's one. Yeah, okay. I can't talk about that. Okay, so very quickly, let's go through some news.
Yeah.
Because some of this is relevant to stuff coming up and also what some of the stuff that happened at Sepang. So very strange thing during qualifying was Livio Supo and Vittorio Goreschi rumors, which is that Goreschi is going to replace Supo as the team director.
That was fired even more by his appearance on the podium to
collect. Right. I was going to get there. but basically, you know, the main driving rumor is this undying rumor of Rossi going to Ducati and supposedly Rossi not getting along with Supo. But I think you and I, Jim, were talking about this when we heard that, and it was I think it's that much much more likely. And I think we exchanged emails with David Emmett, who also was of the same opinion that this is much more has to do with just this whole stoner debacle that happened this year. That you know, it's maybe time for Supo to go. And
well, and your point is well taken. I think it's a personality thing more than a management deal.
Right.
Yeah, and so will it happen? You know, I'm not putting a whole lot of stock in it because everything you read about it, Jules, is coming from the Italians.
Yeah, exactly. But if it were to happen, what an incredibly strange career path for a test rider, because you know Vittorio Goreschi is the Ducati Desmos DG part of the development team. He's the test rider.
I don't think. We know as general race fans what the true scope, and if you think about it, is of a test rider.
That's why I made it a point to say he's part of the development team, which is a lot more than just going on the track and riding the bike and saying, "Well, that worked."
Yeah. You know? No. I Goreschi, you know, he's been around for a long time. He's provided incredible input to Factory Corsa. And I think that were it to happen, I think you do a fine job. But frankly, there is a whole bunch of me that wants to see, you know, a little man love towards Livio Supo because he's a very, very strong presence in the paddock. And I want to see him stay.
Yeah, no, I mean, he's been there since the Ducatis have returned, and so pretty much everything that has to do with Ducati's success has his hand in it in some way, you know.
Yeah, part of me wonders who actually negotiates the deals for Patrick Corsa, because probably wouldn't be best, because he's a very classic, forthright speaker. So I imagine there's some other people that are, you know, he's not like Lynn Jarvis, who's kind of, you know, happy to dress up in a suit and tie. Right. So I don't think we know the whole story, and I don't think it's happening yet. And I just wonder if it's a bit of fluff, you know, people.
It is. It's a bit of fluff, but we just have to, like you said, we have to wait. The only reason why it's worth giving weight to it is because there was a mess during Stoner's absence, with Marlboro possibly, you know, offering Lorenzo ridiculous amounts of money to come to the team, and what that would have meant, and, like, you know, definitely a very, very strange situation. And I think that part of it gives some weight to even something that may just be, you know, a silly rumor generated by Italian press.
I think the tipping point, if you will, was Donington, when he let both guys go out on drives.
Oh, and actually, there was a very, very funny moment this weekend when it started pouring, and Ian, whatever his name is, in the MotoGP pit guy,
Ian Wheeler. Yeah,
was walking around and asking, you know, basically trying to get interviews with somebody, and he caught Supo, and he's like, "Well, so, you know, what do you think? What are you guys going to do to prepare? You know, what does a team do to prepare for this kind of situation?" And Supo was like, just chuckling and saying, "Yeah, I'm not sure I'm the right guy to ask."
Yeah, that was brilliant. That totally cracked me up. But I mean, if anything is going to, like, put a black mark on your team manager resume, I think the fact that they let both of those guys go out on wets at Donington, clearly a gamble, but I mean, Casey was clearly quick, but clearly sick at the same time, quick and sick, is something that probably, you know, people are looking at that going, not the best decision.
Right. Right. Well, he seems to me the kind of guy who, you know, he doesn't want to hear about that kind of stuff. He just expects everybody to be at 100% all the time.
Mm. Well, yeah. Okay.
Before we wrap, we got a note from Gordon Howell at Pole Position Travel that Eugene Laverty, frequent guest on the show and winner of the race at Portimao, and runner-up in the championship, is going to be their guest speaker at Valencia on Friday. They're doing a charity for Down Syndrome in Ireland, and Eugene Laverty will be there. So if you guys are anybody going up to Valencia, it might be worthwhile on Friday. I'm going to find out more details. There's one little detail missing, which is this thing going to be open to the public? My guess is yes. But I will find out, and we'll mention that next show, but just wanted to give that as a early warning.
Cool.
For those of you that are going to Valencia.
Is Gordon listening to our podcast?
He typically does. Yes.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Good. Hi, Gordon.
Hi. Well, okay. Is that about it? Do we have more news?
Happy birthday to Ali Martinez, who runs the fans. The MotoGP OD fan page on Facebook.
Yes.
Her birthday is on Friday, which is when the show comes out. So happy birthday, Ali!
Happy birthday!
And she's the reason why you get the little heart Rossi from MotoGP OD. I have to explain. That's not me or Bob.
The thing is the Facebook page is, you know, it's the MotoGP OD as they are fanboys, because let's face facts, we are fanboys. And but it, since it's run by Allie, it's her fangirl stuff. Otherwise, it'd be heart Nikki Hayden. that Jules was writing.
I would suggest that the three of us sing Happy Birthday to her, but I have a feeling that our voices are probably disharmonious in the worst way.
And the thing is, the thing is, do we want our listeners to have to listen to that? Why don't we can record something separately that we will inflict upon Ali. We don't need to do that to all of the fans out there all over the world.
That'd be great. We'll put it after the screaming down the front straight at Laguna outro. Interim bits that you put together, Bob. But same here. Ali, happy birthday.
Yes. Good stuff. And if you're not on Facebook, or if you are on Facebook but you're not a fan of MotoGP OD, go ahead and look us up there on Facebook, and you can see Ali tells us about new episodes coming out. Oops, and all of that sort of thing. It's great stuff, and we do appreciate it. So,
and I should also mention that MotoGP OD is on Twitter.
Yes,
and we also release episodes there, and I occasionally pop in and throw something kooky out, especially when I'm up at 4 o'clock in the morning. Just search for MotoGPOD on Twitter.
Cool. Yeah, and that's another way you can figure out when new episodes are out, or I don't know, random ramblings or what have you. So,
all right, gentlemen, well done. And wow, we've got one more, and then we're into our winter of despair, aren't we?
Yes.
Yep.
But in any case, a lot of fun talking to you guys. Had a great time. We'll talk to you again soon.
It's good to have you back, especially when you're going to do the edit on a long show.
Yeah, thanks, Joel. Appreciate that one.
All right, ciao.
Ciao.